Carlton Bourne edits the news.
Good evening, everybody. After 3 weeks of fires, bombings, and starvation, Warsaw has surrendered. The French general who saw the charge of the Light Brigade at Balaklava said, "C'est magnifique, mais ce n'est pas la guerre." It's magnificent, but it is not war. And so perhaps we can say of this hopeless defense of the capital of Poland that it too was magnificent, although as a gesture with regard to making war effectively, it was of little worth. But of course, when even Berlin, in announcing the capitulation, pays tribute to the courage of the Polish troops, we will remember it as one of the heroic episodes of this particular war. Perhaps the most pathetic thing about it all is the vain hope of the Warsaw garrison that somehow, sometime, there would come aid from the Allies. And that last message certainly carries its own pathetic message. It is impossible to expect immediate help from the Allies. This is the last message you will receive from us for some time. Yes, it is the last one, and yet, perhaps in a sense, it is not. For the spirit of the defenders of Warsaw represented the spirit of the Polish people. A brave people. A great people. A people that has made its reputation in history. And the mere fact that a fourth partition of Poland has followed the other three by great powers who lack the conscience that is required to permit a little state to have its way in their midst does not mean either that the spirit of Warsaw, that the spirit of the Poles, or that their nationality has been distinguished. Brave Warsaw, we will not forget it. Moscow is again tonight the center of the diplomatic picture. The foreign ministers of Estonia, of Turkey, and of Germany are in the Russian capital. That indicates the importance which Moscow has come to assume in this war. Here are two governments, the German and the Russian, with a cold, realistic attitude towards events. Both want something that other nations have. Germany wants the oil and the wheat of Romania. Russia wants back Bessarabia from Romania. And on the Baltic, Russia wants the Estonian islands in the Baltic Sea and the use of Estonia's ice-free port Tallinn, better known as Reval. And today Moscow announces that a Russian freighter has been sunk off the Estonian coast by a submarine. By a German submarine, we ask, instinctively, because German submarines are the only submarines that have been sighted so far in the Baltic, except that we know that two or three Polish submarines fled across the Baltic in order to find shelter in some neutral harbor. Russian planes today have flown over Estonia. At least, Estonia has protested in Moscow against such flights. And what about the Turkish foreign minister in Moscow? What is he doing there? He was invited to come there by Moscow. His meetings with Herr Ribbentrop will be equally important to his meetings with Molotov. Remember that today, a new Turkish envoy in Berlin presented his credentials and talked to Adolf Hitler for some time. And it's safe to say that the same subjects that have been discussed between the Turkish envoy and Molotov and Ribbentrop in Moscow were also discussed by the new Turkish envoy and Adolf Hitler this afternoon. German aircraft have attacked a British fleet. That's something new in this war. That's a new type of air action. For 2 decades, war experts have bandied away at the question as to whether warships are actually vulnerable to aircraft. Well, what does the battle of today decide on that point? It decides very little because the British and the Germans are in flat contradiction as to what has happened. The British tell us, through the voice of Winston Churchill in the House of Commons, that 20 German planes, seaplanes, participated in the attack. That it took place somewhere near the middle of the North Sea. That would suggest that it was the British line of warships holding the blockade of Germany that was attacked by these German craft. It was a trip for the German planes of only a few hundred miles, imposing no particular strategic problem. The British admit that it was a serious attack, but they say that it failed completely, that it was made on a squadron of capital ships, that absolutely no damage was done, that one of the flying boats was shot down, that another one was damaged, and that a third was obliged to make evidently a forced landing and was captured with its crew. The Germans, on the other hand, as they make the report on this particular event, say that a British aircraft carrier was hit by a bomb and another battleship was damaged. Now, of course, let's say this, that sometimes a flyer thinks he's made a direct hit when he hasn't, and it's his business to get away in a hurry, and he can't stop and fly around the ship two or three times to make sure that he has hit it, for every second that he remains in the vicinity of that ship with all its anti-aircraft batteries going, that second may mean this particular flyer's undoing. And so he dives from a great height at a speed of from 300 to 400 miles an hour. And then as he comes down to a height of perhaps 5,000, possibly 3,000, 2,000 feet, he looses his bombs and then immediately shoots away at the same speed. It's perfectly natural that he should think that he hit the ship, because even a flyer does wishful thinking, and that he may not have hit it. At any rate, it would seem to be pretty difficult for the British to absolutely conceal the fact that any one of their major warships had received serious damage. And in the long run, it probably wouldn't pay them to have Mr. Winston Churchill make a completely false announcement in the House of Commons to that effect. I mention that because that may explain this difference of report from Berlin and from London. France has made the Communist Party illegal. That's a very serious step for France, because there are 76 Communist deputies in the Chamber of Deputies. And there is a very important Communist press. In some respects, I found it brighter and keener than some of the newspapers on the right when I was in Paris a few weeks ago. It formed part of the Popular Front under Léon Blum and his successor, and thereby participated directly in the French government. It's an end of the effort of the French Republic to strike hands with the Communists. Many deputies had already resigned from the party and joined the Socialists. It's the end of the Communist International, so far as democratic countries are concerned. And those misguided idealists who were so enthusiastic about the Soviet state, who saw it as pro, anti-fascist, anti-war, anti-imperialist, now realize that it's really pro-fascist, pro-war, pro-imperialist. I visited the Communist headquarters in Chartres, France, on a Sunday recently, and talked with a fine young chap who was in charge, and must confess that I was amazed at his impractical point of view with reference to the situation that confronted France. Well, these theorists now are pushed to one side. They're not going to have a chance to preach their doctrines in France, and they're going to have very much less chance to preach them successfully in any other country where men believe in decency and in democracy. The Chancellor of the British Exchequer presented his supplementary war budget to the House of Commons this afternoon. The British normal income tax goes to 35%. It's just as well for us to remember that here, if we have any desire to get into war, that that's just one little indication of what war costs financially. And of course, the taxes on beer, on wine, on sugar, tobacco, whiskey are going up even higher, and they were high enough when I was in England a few weeks ago. And war profits are to be taxed 60%, and inheritance taxes are to go up, and Britain is willing and expects to spend $8 billion on the war this year. The government-controlled radio of Berlin claims that England has demanded that Belgium and Luxembourg sell 90% of their iron and steel production to Great Britain. Well, I doubt that England has made any such flat demand. This is a report, of course, that is propaganda. They, of course, are trying to get all they can from the neutral countries around Germany in order to prevent Germany from buying it. And they're able to pay cash. Germany is not. So it's quite possible that all these neutral countries will sell England much more than they'll sell Germany. From the Western Front, I doubt that we get very important news about a big offensive soon. Most experts tell me that that offensive is not coming overnight. I've just been reading Captain Liddell Hart's book, The Defense of Britain. And that explains in detail why, how costly those offensives would be. There are 64 votes for the president's plan on neutrality, we are told, now available in the Senate. That may be an exaggeration, but it's obvious that a big majority is available. The isolationists appear to have lost some strength because of the concessions that the administration forces have made. For example, Senator O'Mahony, I believe it is, a Democrat of Wyoming, who previously was listed among the doubtful senators, said this evening, "I told the president today, I feel that the neutrality bill as it now has been brought out is a largely satisfactory bill." Colonel Lindbergh talked it over with Senator Borah today, and no one of the two had any statement to make as to what was said. The senators favoring the administration bill thought they had Colonel Lindbergh convinced to their point of view when he left them after a session yesterday. And, after all, the debate has only just begun. Watch it and follow it. It's worth your while. Good night.